with some low, low, low down dirty shame.
Does the hiss and crackle of old records make you nostalgic? Is the sound of a phonograph needle hitting vinyl something you miss? I'm Ann Strainchamps, and my guest this morning is going to take us on a magic carpet ride to the past with a historic collection of old 78 RPMs. Nothing brings the past alive like sound, and Henry Sapoznik is back with another treasure trove of old recordings and stories to tell about them. Henry is a Peabody Award-winning, Grammy-nominated ethnomusicologist, performer, and record producer. That's a mouthful. He directs the Mehren Institute for Yiddish Culture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's a regular guest on this program. Henry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
It's always good to see you. So our subject this morning is America's multicultural past through sound, and you've uncovered this gold mine of really old recordings that are ethnically incredibly diverse. Tell us about them.
I think a lot of people are surprised, I mean, especially for the generation that thinks it coined the phrase multiculturalism, to actually look back a century ago and see that commercial record companies, in their quest for the almighty buck, were also doing the good work. They were out there creating a sound document of the American people, the soundtrack of America, as recording grew and as the demographics of America were revealed. And it's a great way to like look back in this kind of unselfconscious self view that these recordings offer us. It's a kind of an interesting moment.
So we're talking about, what, the 1920s, 1930s mostly?
Ooh, go back. Go
oh,
back.
Earlier?
Oh, yeah. We are going back into a previous century. Commercial recording really began at the end of the 19th century and kind of caught its real momentum in the 1890s with cylinder recordings. Oh. So, yeah, we're actually able to listen to recordings that are more than 100 years old. It makes a guy like me kind of tingly, you know, think that I could leave that, you know, actually hear this stuff that was when people, you know, who were alive, who had known Abraham Lincoln.
And you're a native New Yorker, and I assume most of these were recorded in New York. That's where the first record companies must have been. Right?
A lot of the recording was done in New York for a lot of reasons. It was the center of recording. But
so we're getting this portrait of the melting pot that was New York, the center of immigrant culture, you know, from putting aside the West Coast, that's another story, but this wonderful melting pot, rich culture that we all learned about in, you know, junior high school or something, but you can hear it.
Yeah, and we actually hear it in real time. I mean, New York was the magnet. I mean, as we will find when you start going through the history of recording, that it was not only the guys in the record companies, Columbia and Victor and Edison, who looked at Ellis Island and saw, ooh, profits, you know, like, ooh, customers. And they repackaged the culture in kind of not in a different way than like Dole Pineapple saw a natural resource in Hawaii, you know, and sort of took the natural resource, repackaged it, and then sold it back to the very people.
Henry, you're so cynical.
Oh, was that me? Was I thinking that or did I actually say it? No, it's actually all about the creation of marketing and of society. I mean, people want to hear their own music. And the great thing is that the creation of these recordings by these commercial companies was reasonably unfettered. There wasn't a lot of mixing in with saying, oh, your people don't want to hear this. I mean, there was a certain amount of social engineering. But we get to hear, the whole point was, if this was not authentic, it would not sell. So there was one of the few times that the marketplace, the unfettered Adam Smith marketplace, actually worked in our favor. The irony, of course, is that at the same time that there were these actual ethnic recordings, in other catalogs, there were ethnic stereotype recordings, which were equally as popular. And they make a really fascinating...
What do you mean by ethnic stereotype recordings?
American popular music invented in the mid-19th century is created on the foundation of minstrelsy, of the creation of blackface, white performers.
White guys in blackface.
In blackface. And this was American popular music for the vast part of the 19th century, and in fact set the standard for how American popular music, starting from a black template, created a white version. And then we just go back from minstrelsy through ragtime and jazz and rhythm and blues and rap.
And I know, I was going to say, well, today, rap.
Here it is.
The same old story.
Here it is. And so this is where it really started. So by going back and listening to these old recordings, we see this unbroken narrative of popular culture and American social engineering.
Mm. Well, we should hear something. Let's go back and hear the cut we played at the very beginning of the show, because I talked over it, so we didn't get to hear it. So let's hear it without me jabbering.
It's a low, it's a low, low, okay. Low down dirty shade. It's a low, it's a low, low, low down dirty shade. I got a broken mane, but I guess you call it name.
So who are we listening to?
This is a fascinating, one of the great real carriers of traditional music. Her name was Geechee Wiley. We don't really know much about her, and that's what's so great about these commercial recordings. People sort of floated into a recording studio at this pristine moment with an instrument, recorded something, and then disappeared. What's really great about her is that when the record companies finally started to acknowledge that there was Southern culture in the 1920s and recording both hillbilly music and blues, urban blues sung by women was very popular. I think the best known singer of that era was Bessie Smith. Geechee Wiley, however, was doing Delta blues, was doing Southern blues. Very few women could compete. It was a male-driven musical scene. And here is this woman who has got fabulous singing skills, great, really robust guitar, and a terrific example of how the tradition crossed both lines.
Yeah, Henry, I'm looking at the liner notes, and it looks like this was recorded in Grafton, Wisconsin. What is a woman who's singing the Delta blues doing in Grafton, Wisconsin recording?
What a great story is this about Paramount Records. This is one of the most bizarre. If this was a movie, I would say this is the stupidest script. A chair company in Grafton takes on a job for a record company in Chicago to press black records for the black community. The original company in Chicago goes out of business. The chair company in Grafton says, oh, we'll go into the record business now. And suddenly this little place is transformed into Paramount Records, which was a magnum of he only knows.
So would they actually, people from the South would make the trek all the way up to Grafton, Wisconsin to record a record?
They would do both that. And of course, Chicago at that time, the
Chicago
Great Migration was in you know, the beginning flux. So it became a real, and Grafton had to deal with these issues of segregation and how to accommodate the fact that this is a local industry. Anyway, Paramount Records are a great unknown story about the Wisconsin story.
Mm. So, Henry, I'm old enough to remember the first CDs appearing and how clean they sounded. You know, it felt like there was just nothing between you and the music, and we all fell for it, right? But today, a lot of music lovers are going back to vinyl. What do old records offer, do you think, that CDs or today music streaming or digital downloads don't?
I think one of the great things, certainly about vinyl, and before that, shellac, which is what these records are made out of, there's a sense of place. I mean, when that needle slips into the groove, you immediately, that kind of sonic sepia that I call it, takes you into a certain place. Mostly, you know, the concept of what is sound and what is noise is a personal aesthetic that has been sort of emerging over years. Take out all of the quote-unquote noise, and supposedly what you are left with is pristine sound, rather than an airless tube that the lack of sound context creates. So we listen to these old records, and yeah, it sounds like, you know, quit making the bacon in the back room. This is a great example of how we are taken into the listening space of the people who originally owned these records.
Okay, let's hear something else. This is Kansas City Stomps, Jelly Roll Morton's Red Hot Peppers.
Thank you.
God, doesn't that take you back?
And it may not.
I mean,
bring
I wasn't even
back.
Alive then, but I guess through seeing so many old, wonderful movies, that I just feel like you've stepped back into an era listening to that.
You know, a part of it is what's great about listening to the recordings of a particular era, when both the technology and the music were in development, is that we are hearing this as it emerges, fully formed from the people who created it. It's not. I mean, yeah, this has been going on. When Jelly Roll Morton recorded this record in 1928, I mean, he had been a phenomenon in New Orleans music since the teens and earlier. It took the record companies quite a long time to catch on. The first, quote-unquote, jazz records were made by white groups that were, again, the same thing that we're talking about, a black provenance music that is the first pioneers are white performers. So we're hearing the creation of this music in real time by the people in the studio. Something else, this freaks people out. All of these records, everything we're listening to, recorded with one microphone.
One mic?
Ah.
For all those, how big a group was
there
that?
There we go. That is one of the great. I think it was Sgt. Pepper that was the first record with multi-tracking. They learned how to physically place themselves around the microphone. And by the way, the microphone did not happen until just a year or so before Jelly Roll Morton made this fabulous record.
Okay, wait. Now I want to hear a little bit of it again, just because I can't believe that's one microphone.
You hear everything. You hear every, and that's one of the interesting things about the mixture of an art that predated recording. The relationship of the artist to the recording was not just the fact that here they would be playing a tune in context if they're playing at a club or a sporting house, as they were euphemistically referred to. They'd be playing for 20 minutes, a half hour. Suddenly they have to make a record. You got 3 minutes, buddy.
Oh, that's so they could not play longer than 3 minutes?
They could not play longer than 3 minutes. So they
and there's only one song on the record, or on one
per side.
So it's once a three-minute-long record.
Reasonably 3 minutes, unless you were really lucky and they gave you a 12-inch record, in which case you got an extra minute. So the idea is that they had to rethink how they performed their music. So it's not just the running time of the music, but they had to create a relationship to the microphone or to the recording horn. So it's a lot of stuff going on at the same time that makes these early recordings, you know, you have to have your jaw surgically removed from the floor because you just say, oh my God, I can't believe, how did they do this?
But what I love is this idea that we're listening to the birth of a new musical genre. I mean, that's the very beginning of jazz, right?
It's really, really, I mean, there had been, again, we are crippled in a way because of the record company's unwillingness to, I mean, that was the whole point, that a mediated music that wasn't really grassroots music. We didn't hear the first recordings when Buddy Bolden, who was Jelly Roll Morton's mentor and Louis Armstrong's mentor when he was playing, the recording industry existed at that point. We know about, you know, Edison made the first tinfoil recordings in the late 1870s. But we get one of the interesting things, and this is one of the things I'm doing in this course that I'm teaching now on historic recordings, is that once in a while you get a performer who shows up who reflects a style that is decades older than that moment. Jelly Roll Morton, what's being played here, is up to the minute. It's still got its showroom shine. But once in a while we get to hear someone who reflects a style that was decades earlier, which means we get to eavesdrop on an earlier generation. We get an extra 30 years to really hear what people were listening to. Ooh, makes me tingle just talking about it.
So much fun. We're talking with Henry Sapoznik. He's an ethnomusicologist, performer, director of the Mehren Institute for Yiddish Culture at the UW-Madison, 5-time Grammy Award nominee, winner of the 2002 Peabody Award. As he said, he's teaching a course at the UW-Madison on Spirit of 78. So we'll get him to tell us more about it after the break. And also, after the break, you can join our conversation. Are you a fan of old vinyl recordings yourself? Call and tell us why. Or maybe you have a collection of old 78s yourself that means something to you. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or chime in on our Facebook page, 45 North on WPR. Friend us while you're there so you can keep up with our news. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ann Strangechamps, and we're talking this morning with Henry Sapoznik. We're talking about the multicultural history of America through sound, through old 78 RPMs. Looking for your phone calls also if you are a collector of old, perhaps you're a collector of old records and have something you'd like to tell us about. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. And Henry, you're going to be teaching a class, right? You mentioned it, Spirit of 78s. What is that?
Yeah, I'm teaching a class. You know, part of my work here as the director of the Mehrent Institute for Yiddish Culture is I get to babysit a collection of 9,000 Yiddish 78s from the 1890s through the 1950s. So that's you know, don't pinch me and wake me up kind of moment. So the great thing is that the Mills Library here has one of the most outstanding collection of 78 RPM records, and the will and design to share them with the community. It's a real great gift to us as a society. So I'm trying to do courses that really raise the consciousness about historic recordings. And this course, again, called The Spirit of 78's America's Sound Legacy, really introduces people to lost sounds that are really part of a daily experience of our predecessors. So,
but this is open to the public, right? Not just
wide open to the public. That's right. It's a continuing education course. Maybe if your listeners, we can post the information.
Sure. Check our website or our Facebook page. Facebook is 45 North on WPR. Website is reversed, wpr.org/45North. So yeah, we'll put plenty of information there. Hey, we've got a caller. Let's go to Jan in Ashland is going to join our conversation. Hey, Jan.
Hi, good morning. I'm so excited about this, and I'm sure that everybody who knows me is going, yep, Jan's excited about this. I started collecting Victrolas, crank Victrolas, many years ago now. I think of how far back it was.
Jan, why?
Well, because I'm fascinated by them. They're simple, but they're elegant. Beautiful pieces of furniture, some of them. I even have one in a suitcase, in a small suitcase that I keep in the back of my old car so that I can play vintage music when I go to car shows. But I started giving those Victrolas away because they take up a lot of room.
They're a big piece of furniture.
So I was giving them to my daughters and my nieces. The one cute story was when the nieces came up from Milwaukee and ran up the stairs and said, "Oh, Mom, you've got to come upstairs and see Auntie Jan's music box." And to those people who had seen only tapes or CDs, this was a music box with these discs that you put in. So I've seen to it that all three of my daughters and my nieces have crank Victrolas, and I still have like three of them. Four of them, excuse me. But I love them. I go upstairs and I play them in the foxtrots and the jazz, and I have what I think is maybe a little valuable, but I'm not sure, and that's the original recording of the Big Rock Candy Mountain. So some of them are just too wonderful. They're fun to play with.
Are these the, when you say Victrola, I'm picturing those things that had the great big kind of horn that came out like the mouth of a tuba?
The earliest was what they called the morning glory horns.
The morning glory. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Henry. I'm just enjoying the daylights out of this. I have one like that, but then the rest are these beautiful pieces of cabinet furniture, and they're just gorgeous. The top opens up, and you you crank the crank, and you only do that so many times, though. You don't want to blow one of your springs. I mean, once that happens, you have to take it to Green Bay to have it fixed, and it's really expensive.
This is the place to get it fixed.
Jan, thank you so much. That's just a great story. Who knew? I'm so curious to know if there are other collectors of old 78 RPMs out there, or the equipment to play them on. Henry, when you started getting interested in old recordings, where did you even go to find them?
In the 1970s, I mean, there were, you know, the whole issue of listening to old records was an invention of the of a post market. That is, a lot of people who got into listening to this music were listening to it because the record companies would not re-release this stuff. The record companies were kind of like sharks. They would only work moving forward. So by the 1930s and 40s, you started getting people who wanted to listen to music out of time. They wanted to listen to music from an earlier generation. So collectors, the creation of what's called discographies, which are lists of records like a bibliography, were like the key. They were kind of like the Sears Roebuck catalog. If when you had a discography, you'd say, oh my God, this record is out there somewhere. And record collectors, jazz record collectors at the beginning, and eventually hillbilly and blues collectors, these were people who really traded amongst each other. The rise of reissues in the 1950s and 60s really helped to stimulate the world of listening to this music.
But are these the kinds of things that people are still, you know, picking up at flea markets or garage sales, or finding in their attics?
eBay is the major engine. In fact, that's what a lot of Sherry Mayrent, who created her own collection, used to be. There would be regional record swaps, and people would get together. It was a very tactile experience. Now, of course, on eBay, you just see more records being offered in a day than you probably would have been able to find in like 6 months.
Well, Henry, I have a surprise for you. I brought you a present.
Oh my God, it's an old 78 album.
So here's...
Wow, these are...
Here's the story.
Oh my God, there's more.
Here, I'm handing them over right now. These things are heavy.
Where's my bureau? I gotta get... Wow.
Here's the story. I was in Vermont this summer visiting my parents, and they said it was a Saturday morning, and we were a little bored, and they said, oh, we'll take you to the Chelsea Mall. Well, Chelsea is a tiny little hamlet. You know, there's a post office and a few houses. And the Chelsea Mall, this is the locals' joke, is actually the little neighborhood swap shop, which is in a little shack off the Village Green. And it's only open Saturday mornings. And if you have something you don't want, you drop it off there. The neighbors go in, check and see if there's anything you want. So I was in there looking at, you know, the old canning bottles and stuff. And here are these two albums filled with these hard old 78 RPMs, and I thought of you, Henry, so I dragged them all the way back, and they're heavy.
These are shellac records.
But I have no idea if there's anything worthwhile. They're probably all, you know,
I'm holding up not a valuable copy of Pupalina by the Gaylords with George Annis and his orchestra. I have no idea who this is. These are great. These are like transmissions from a parallel universe that finally get to us, these little shellac transmissions. And we show up and say, oh my God, the Gaylords. I said, really? We are now plugging a hole with these old. This is really cool. This is, by the way, this is.
All right, there you go, because there's nothing. I mean, I don't have a way to play them. So.
Well, you know, there are people, there are a bunch of acoustic shut-ins like myself who really. In fact, I had this situation at my class the other day. I brought in a CD to play, and it wouldn't play. So, but a 78, if you crank up a 78 machine, that thing
Henry,
will play.
Oh, you can't play a CD, but you can play a 78.
Don't go into, you know, my ironometer always goes off when I talk about, you know, ancient Andaluvian technology being still functional, when in fact you can't do this other stuff.
Well, let's hear some more music. So
music.
You also brought us, I mean, we're going back to, I want to talk more about that whole multicultural portrait of earlier America. So you also brought in a Chinese opera. What is this? Parting at Yangquan.
This is actually, it's a instrumental part of a larger composition, which includes a Chinese opera. This is a fascinating recording. This was made in New York in the late 1930s. The performer is a composer named Wei Chung Lo, and just so happened he was touring in the United States with some other performers who played traditional Chinese music and opera, and came to a small record label in Manhattan and offered to make this record for them. In one session, it was one afternoon in 1939, and it is it's a series of little audio snapshots of what is this moment in kind of the self-realization. This music, it seems incongruous, and yet it was is part of a much larger acoustic picture.
Okay, let's listen. Moving. As a string performer yourself, what do you notice? What do you hear?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the chin has been described as a zither, but I recently got into playing a Hawaiian lap steel guitar, and this is more like a lap steel guitar. It's played flat on its back, and instead of using a bar as on the Hawaiian guitar, the performer uses their thumb. So there, what it allows is a vocalization without frets. You can vocalize, you can play music that sounds very much like the human voice. Traditional music places a great value on instrumental skills which can emulate the human voice. And something like this, which is a composed piece in the traditional style, is a really kind of a modernist way of using old forms to inform a new generation. It's it's really fabulous. And it's a great document both of the moment and for us today. It's still very valid.
It's so spare, and yet each of those notes, you know, sort of opens up into their overtones and undertones.
That's a really great observation, because that's what you get for not having a digitally, not having a remastering that compresses the noise. In that in the sonic hiss, there is overtones. And those overtones give breadth and diversity to the sound. Once you get rid of that hiss, you lose an incredible place in terms of how sound is created.
Oh, okay. Well, let's listen to something else. We're, again, talking about the multicultural history of America through sound. And a shout-out, by the way, to listeners, if you would like to join our conversation, perhaps you also are a collector of old recordings or have some feeling of connection to old recordings. Maybe there's something that's in your family that you care about, or kind of music from your own family or your own community's past that you've come to appreciate more as an adult. You can join our conversation. It's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. So, Henry, you also brought us something from Little Italy. I'm thinking this is, what is this, Alfredo Smith? Tell us about this.
This is a great recording. First of all, give some context. This recording is from a new anthology that was locally made. There is a luthier here in Madison, Todd Cambio, a great guitar builder and a big advocate, collector of Italian 78s. And this is from a new anthology that he produced. I helped a little bit. And it's the first anthology of American, Italian, and Italian music from this period. I chose this because it's a fabulous insight into the kind of acculturation dynamic that traditional music, here we've just heard before, the Chinese piece is unfettered piece that takes us into it, the past of that music. There's nothing that keeps us from thinking about the music in its historical setting. Here we're going to listen to a piece that just bubbles over with its place in New York and the Italian community in the 1920s. It's a piece called Avia Alfredo Smith, and it means hooray for Al Smith. Al Smith was a presidential candidate in the late 1920s, and was incredibly popular among ethnic communities because he was a Catholic, a visibly practicing Catholic. And this is what brought people to him, and this is, of course, what caused his downfall as a presidential candidate. But quite a number of people took to his cause. What I really like is recordings like this, which reflect a kind of a really crystalline moment. It's a kind of like a street singer on a street corner singing something about a newsreel, an audio newsreel.
And so, would this have been like a campaign song?
This is a campaign song.
Okay, let's take a listen.
Tutti Stati Uniti, sienta sulla nuova, e chi le nu grandomma, sapete voi chi è? È Mr. Alfredo Smith, o gran governatore, e noi con tutto cora, o voto l'immata. A sta grande repubblica sa fa l'elezione, o presidente cagnere e che sta nazione, c'è voluto democratico, ma che stogna una ritta, non c'è per dimmi in chiacchiera, volimmo Alfredo Smith. Zima con noi a lucca tutta gente, volimmo Alfredo Smith presidente, e viva Alfredo Smith!
Viva Alfredo Smith.
I wonder what that means.
Yeah. It means long live Alfredo Smith.
Absolutely. What's really great is like this is a staged recreation of a campaign stop in Little Italy for Al Smith, including having all the musicians say, yay, you know, so Giuseppe Milano, had just the year before had just done a recreation of the funeral of Valentino. So it's really great that these pieces kind of like give this tactile moment of how people were listening.
Well, I'm going to welcome in some folks on the line. We've got Klaus calling from Middleton. Hi, Klaus.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for putting me on. I'm one of those collectors, and I have very special interests. My interests are next to a certain performer, Henry Burr, prolific singer
incredibly.
In the 1920s.
I don't think an old recording over the phone is probably the best. Like the radio bosses will not be happy.
But my interests are also social, especially World War I related, and there is a sleuth off material. And it's interesting from my point of view, I was born and raised in Germany, how different the World War I music is and what an important place it took in the war effort. And so I have lots of records that I have about 30 records of 50 or 60 recordings of war related music.
And are they all on the American side, or were there German records made?
No. I'm strictly talking about the American side.
Stuff and like Over There, How Are You Going to Keep Him Down on the Farm? Yeah, those are critical. But there were, before America entered the war, there were recordings issued in the United States, which also were about the German war effort, because, again, there was a large German population here.
Right. Well, the Germans were somewhat distrusted, not quite as much as the Japanese during World War II.
Well, that's a different war.
That's very different. And there's one song don't bite the hand that feeds you. If you are from a different country, i.e. from Germany, then go back. If you don't like Uncle Sam, go back to where you came from.
There's a lot of people still singing that song in certain quarters today.
Klaus, thank you so much. That's just fascinating. And we've also got Dave on the line from Balsam Lake. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. Do you have a collection?
My uncle Salvin, in 1925, started one of the first radio stations in Iowa, even before WOC in Davenport. But he was in Elwood, which still has 47 souls in it. At any rate, I have about 2 feet of his 78 records, and among that bunch are some single-sided cardboard records with a photograph of Rudy Valley on the back when he must be in his early 20s or something. And I was just wondering what you think of those. And
cardboard records.
Those are probably, those are what they were called, acetates. There were a whole bunch of alternative forms for how to make records, especially radio.
Okay.
Used aluminum discs at the beginning, and during the war, when aluminum was in very short supply, they made them out of glass.
Glass records.
Whoa. So cardboard, it's a cardboard base and a very thin.
It's like a composite.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was thinking of something that more like paper that could mold, and I was amazed they were still around.
It is rare for them to be around because the cardboard is high acid and it eats through to the top of the disc. But those are not meant for repeated plays. Those are acetates that are pretty fragile.
So does Dave's collection make you salivate, or
I'm going to bring my foul weather gear in for the next time. I mean, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that is really important because it was ephemera within the ephemera. These were not meant for mass distribution. So when these things survived, and the fact that it was affiliated with an historic record, a radio station, gives it all the more. I mean, provenance is just dripping out of it. So it's a really probably fabulous piece. And hopefully it was before, maybe when Rudy Valley still used his megaphone.
Dave, what are you doing with all these things?
I'm just storing them. About every 6 years or so, my wife and I talk about selling them. And she says, I think we should. And I say, I don't think we should. So we still have them. And at some point, we've got to, get rid of them at some point. But I remember when I was 4 or 5, 6 years old, playing in his workshop, and it was just wonderful. He had never married. My grandpa died in 1931, and he felt an obligation to take care of all the sisters and mom. So he didn't have an opportunity to do any formal schooling, but he was so bright.
Wow, that's just an amazing piece of family history.
He ran the lines for the Elwood Railroad, for the Elwood, Iowa Telephone Company.
Wow.
And I remember when I was 6, 7, 5, 6, 7, I'd sit on Bessie's knee, and she still had the old plug-in telephone apparatus, But those phonographs are just so neat. The old records are just so neat, and I don't think I'll ever get rid of them.
Well, that's good. Hold on to them. And we've also got Jerry on the line from Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Did you have a question or comment?
Well, just a comment. I've kept my 78s recordings of the hillbilly music that I loved in the early 1950s. And so I've got Hank Snow and Hank Williams.
Sure.
And
all those great Hanks.
Ernie Tubbs. And what was interesting was that my brother, who was born in 41, my younger brother, wanted to expose his sons to great hillbilly music. So I made a recording of my 78s and put them on tape and sent it to him so they got a chance to listen to what this music was really like, really good country music, not just modern stuff.
Oh, that's great. Well, Henry, this is exactly what you did, right? Because you began as a performer of kind of hillbilly-ish music.
Actually, the earliest strata. What this caller was talking about was kind of like the middle period of the post-war. Hillbilly music was first recorded in the early 1920s. In fact, in my class, I'm going to play what I believe is actually the first Southern recording. It's from 1909. So anyway, the history of this music goes back and can still inspire people.
All right, we're going to take a really quick break. And when we come back, actually, you brought us a piece of old hillbilly music. So we'll take a listen. We're talking with Henry Sapoznik. He's an ethnomusicologist, performer, and director of the Mehren Institute for Yiddish Culture at the UW-Madison. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Coming up at 10 tonight, it's Snap Judgment. This week, Losing My Religion. The great teachers were all reformers. Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, they all demanded a break with belief before reaching a new level of comprehension. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're talking about historic 78 RPMs with ethnomusicologist and record producer and performer Henry Sapoznik. And Henry, we were talking about hillbilly music right before the break, and you brought us a piece of very old hillbilly music. Tell us about it.
This is one of the first. What's really interesting is that the record companies for decades were recording and distributing records into communities that it was not recording. So in the South, they had been getting, for years, thousands of records recorded in New York. And at a certain point in the early 1920s, some of these performers down there said, wait a second, this is not right. They got on a train and they went up to New York, showed up on the doorstep of record companies and said, here we are, deal with it. From North Carolina named Charlie Poole. And he took two of his fellow mill workers, and they went up to New York, planted themselves on the doorstep of Columbia Records, played what will be the tune we will hear imminently, played six measures, and they said, okay, get in the studio. They released it, sold 102,000 copies at a time that there were less than 7,000 phonographs in the American South. What it did was it helped to show that there was this untapped market. So while the record company said, oh, good, more hillbilly, there's gold in them, there are hillbillies kind of thing. But it also meant that we documented the earliest stage of country music of the teens and 20s. A great moment.
Okay, so let's hear. This is Don't Let Your Deal Go Down, Charlie Poole and his North Carolina Ramblers. Henry, he's actually kind of hard to understand. I know he's got that southern, that hillbilly accent, but do you find him a little hard to understand?
This is one of the great puzzles of early recording. Charlie Poole both had a desire to be misunderstood, but also he got into a fight. He was a drinking man. Let's just say he enjoyed a little hair of the dog, and was caught in a moonshine club in the South. And the police, when trying to arrest him, attempted to shoot him, and he pushed the gun away from his head, and it went off near his mouth and shattered his teeth. And so what we're hearing is both. Yeah, this will make a great movie. Let's think about who's going to be Charlie Poole in the film version of
Johnny Depp.
Ooh, now there's.
Oh, but wow. So what you're hearing is you hear the sound of his life. That's why he doesn't enunciate so clearly.
Well, and it's everything. I mean, his songs and Charlie Poole's songs were in a lot of ways very autobiographical. He was a rambler. a North Carolina rambler, never stayed in one place. But his sound is so unique, and the sound we're hearing of his ensemble is basically the DNA of bluegrass. This was a sound that didn't exist before he and the two people with whom he played invented it. So, again, this is the first recording of Charlie Poole, so we're hearing the eggshell chirpings of not only his music, but what would be a large and vibrant part of the country music legacy.
Well, and here's one of the valuable things about having these old recordings is when you get modern performers like you yourself, you know, wanted to, when you began performing, you were interested in some of this old music. Well, where do you learn to play it? You kind of have to go back to find the original people. You sought out some of the original performers, didn't you, who were down in North Carolina?
That's actually right. I mean, the idea of listening to these records is really fabulous, but the idea of going back and meeting the people who actually made the records gives it a dimension out. Interestingly, even though Southern music for me, which was like my first real love in terms of a discovered music, had enough players who still carried on the old traditions that you did not need the 78s per se. I mean, you do need them because they reflected a regional diversity that the records, because it created a popularity of these records. But the only actual genre where the 78 records have been critical in the cultural continuity of a music form has been in Yiddish music, in klezmer music, where the vast majority, huge cultural discontinuity and the change in the culture. So finding those records has been more critical to creating a new generation of literate musicians who use these records as their teachers, as a cross-generational teaching. It's really an amazing moment.
All right, you're setting up our last recording, but I want to take one more call. First, we've got Mike on the line from Kewaskum. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hey, did you have a comment?
I'm not a collector. I'm actually an auctioneer, but as a result of that, I see a lot of the market and the demand for what's out there, and it's interesting that you had mentioned the Port Washington studios earlier in Grafton. You would think that more of those Paramount records would turn up in this area, but when you consider the number of conservative old Germans around here, not so much. Mm-hmm. They weren't really into the race music, so a lot of it is foxtrots and waltzes and classical, but there is a strong demand for the players themselves. I don't collect, although I do own a Edison Opera and a Aretino outside horn disc player, and there's just huge demand for that stuff, and it's a lot of younger people who don't necessarily have a tie to the memories. They enjoy the technology and just the pleasure and the novelty of it.
The thing I try to tell people is what most people don't know is that the recording technology was decades more sophisticated than the playback technology. Best thing to do with those old records, don't play them on those old machines because they rip them up to pieces. We have good modern technology to get great sound out of those records. So they're wonderful pieces of furniture.
All right. Well, Henry, we're coming up on the end of the hour. It's always great to have you here. Henry Sapoznik is ethnomusicologist, performer, director of the Mehrin Institute for Yiddish Culture at the UW-Madison. He's a regular guest here on this program. And I also want to say thanks to Marika Suval, Rhonda Fanning, Dave Potraz, and Joe Hartke. And we're going to go out with some music. And Henry, real quickly, why don't you tell us what we're going to listen to? This is a song called Russia, the Russian Scissors Dance.
Yeah. This is great. I've got this recording from the daughter of the man who was playing on this, and it's just really thrilling to have a personal thing. This was one of the great Yiddish dance records of the 1920s. Abe Schwartz, who is playing here, who's the fiddle player and band leader, leads a muscular and absolutely vibrant orchestra playing a very, very traditional piece, and you can't help but want to get up and dance in any language.
All right. Well, so we'll say goodbye with this.